Welcome back to All My Darlings, where we are reading Harpsong for a Radical, The Life and Times of Eugene Victor Debs, written by Marguerite Young. We're on page 31. And we have a bit of a longer chapter by way of chapter 9. It's a couple pages. All right. The fallen away Roman Catholic Wilhelm Wittling, who in Switzerland continued to employ the sacred images of Roman Catholicism while attacking Orthodox theologians, had caused some rival socialists to look upon him as an incendiary tramp without much substantial thought, and others to suspect in him an ill-founded messianic illusional state, and one of his disciples to believe that he was his parody of the Lord's Prayer, was guilty of entertaining the ambition to become the new pope of communism. Whatever he had intended, it was not to be the pope's nose. He had fed crumbs to the swans on the lake. To save the money, he would have had to pay for a laundry bill, for he had needed every cent for the printer's bill, the strewing of his seeds of propaganda. He'd begun to go without underwear or socks. To symbolize the revolution, which was about to come, he had begun to wear the red cap to symbolize the martyrdom of the worker Christ. He was the one who knew the way to the earthly paradise which was to come, the golden way gleaming through clouds of darkness, and knew it simply by instinct. Utopia was that which was outside of history. It came because it must. The bastard had cried loud in workers' cells that all children should be equal in the eyes of God. We are all children of one Father, and we all have a common destiny to be happy here, and then forever in the great beyond. Wilhelm Wittling had not believed that coins should be stamped with the heads of emperors and kings. In their stead there should appear such emblems of labor as the hammer and the anvil and the chisel and the saw, and words that proclaimed, even to a blind man reading Braille with his fingertips, the promise that their value was worth one loaf of bread or 1 pound of meat. For his increasingly radical writings and revolutionary speeches, which threatened to start avalanches burying old societies for the sake of others, the humble man spread the word of the Red Christ, had been closed in on by the police at 3 o'clock in the morning on June 9, 1843, and thrown into prison, there to wait for trial for having committed no crime but the crime of spreading his anarchic socialist or communist messages, which seemed to be gaining converts by the ton. Zurich was yielding to the pressure of German and Austrian and other emperors and kings, who had sent their detectives to watch Wittling's every move and report on every word he said or wrote. Condemned to a prison cell in Switzerland for his mockery of the words of God and his verbal attacks on social and economic institutions, which were in general even more sacrosanct than the words of God, he was found by the Swiss to be no threat to the government nor to the established religious and banking institutions with his revolutionary red-cap messages. But they had determined that he who was already a borderline case, and to learn a fog-bound kingdom between the sane and the insane, should return to prison. When he was released, he would be sent entirely over the borderline that divided Switzerland from other lands. I never got that. Like, religions get so upset if they something's said against them. I was like, if your God's that strong, buddy. He had already served 4 months and now had 6 months more tacked onto a sentence before exile for 5 years from every Swiss canton where there was in an intricate country. Oh, every Swiss canton there was in an intricate country where, as might be seen when an avalanche occurred, there were more cantons than anyone knew there were. Wilhelm Wittling's last speech before the court had been mainly an attempt to refute the charge of blasphemy. He had shown Christ as a man who had loved to pick flowers. Christ had been such a very human man that he had aroused, because of an insult he had paid to Judas, the vast response of his betrayal by the Judas cock, without whom there would have been no crucifixion, no resurrection, and no millennial cock like that which was promised. Now that Christ would soon return, or perhaps had already returned, or perhaps had never really left the earth, or had been in and out many times as some mystical communitarians of the Swedenborgian or older supernatural assumptions believed, in view of the awesome fact that there was no exact borderline between what was possible and what was impossible. The Communist Chronicle of London had announced, as Wilhelm Wittling had been returned like a ragged tramp to his tomb in the Switzerland where the poor in some cantons suffered as much as the poor in other countries, a tragedy made evident by the number who seemed believers in the artisan communal earthly paradise which was to come and who wanted to get out in order to go from the old world to the new world, which was as present phantasmal a dream in men's minds. Our dear brother, Witling, is now a martyr. The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The bruised geranium leaf smelleth more sweetly. Meanwhile, although not free in person, the thoughts of Witling are commingling with ours and flying abroad like down-winged seeds over our common earth of green and gold. Since the French Revolution of 1791, we enumerate three illustrious communist martyrs: Babeuf of France, Joshua Jacob of Ireland, and Wilhelm Witling of Germany. Blessings upon them, as far as they should be blessed. When Witling was told that 50 francs were on the way to his assistance, he had assumed that 50 brothers from Frankfurt were coming to batter down the walls. No army had come through the night to his rescue. He had suffered as much derangement of his senses in his cold, dark prison cell as if quicksilver had been packed into his ears. He had heard knockings on the walls, voices crying, shoutings. He had seen the eyes of the Austrian detective staring at him continually through two peepholes in the wall, so that he in his isolation enjoyed no sense of privacy whatever. He had developed strange burnings in his chest and could not sneeze without the sense that he was being killed. He had been afraid to accept a clean nightshirt from his jailer lest they should attempt to strangle him and hang him by its long sleeves. He had refused to accept a cup of water or a cup of wine, lest it should contain a few lethal drops that might put him into a sleep from which there would be no awakening. Some people always to think that the world of sleep and dreams was his. He had heard continually the sound of a boy blowing a wooden trumpet, a dog barking at a bone by a lonely shore, as he had remembered the holy images of mother and child he had known in his youth. He had declared a letter from his poor mother, who was living, he believed, on public alms in Magdeburg, just such crumbs as the community would allow to her, was not in her handwriting. It was a forgery, for the spelling was not hers, and the words were not those which she would have written to him. He had been driven almost completely out of his bird by his sincere but erroneous belief that the sons of Calvin had stolen from him the letters and the strand of his grandmother's hair and the strand of his mother's hair that he had carried on his person throughout the years of his wanderings and that were more precious to him than strands of silver and gold. To try to save his very nervous mind and frayed nerves and broken strings from total collapse into the primordial chaos, he had begun to pass the time in his tomb by combing with a fine-tooth comb the Bible in search of new pearls of wisdom to add to his crusader shield if ever he should emerge. He had been sane enough to continue with his studies of the English language, for he was planning to migrate to England and possibly also to America in quest of the site for an earthly paradise or New Jerusalem that would operate in accordance with his visionary system, and was not left to chance. He had not particularly wished to go to America, possibly because that would have been for him another and lasting exile, possibly because for him, as for others, it was the great unknown, possibly because it was the known. While in the prison trying to evolve his thoughts upon the subject of the universal tongue, Wilhelm Witling had been sure that the universal tongue, which he envisioned, would require that complexities be replaced by clarities, as in the language of children. In the process of evolving it, he had worked on his very individualistic verse, which expressed his shattered ego. Although he might seem to himself a second Christ, he did not think of himself as a genius in the writing of poems, but felt that they might fill a vacuum that had never been expressed before in the German tongue, as no one before him had suffered or recorded an experience which was unique. He had had the talents with which to do so, as he also had the love of old romance from the days of his childhood in Magdeburg, the place which he most feared and loved. The poems that recorded his wounds as the bastard son of the little toy soldier who had disappeared in the Russian snow had included along with Conscience, Temptation, The Betrayer, Address to My Judge and to My Prosecutor, his sufferings under the gaze of the monster, who was the Austrian detective staring at him through the peephole in the wall, 48 Hours in the Dark, which told of the flutterings of his pulse, the rush of blood to his head, his hunger, coughings of the sick in other cells, and Night, which told of the jailer making his rounds and rattling his keys in the beautiful morning, with his first faint beams of light, which had made him wonder if he would ever see the light of the day bringing his release, and for how long. Poems entitled The Little Bird, The Sun, The Moon, The Christmas Tree, and Do Not Despair were among those providing balsam, as were those containing memories of his mother and those asking for strength to bear his cross. To some of Witling's critics, he was just plain cuckoo, the kind of bird who had no nest of his own and wanted to lay his egg in some other bird's nest, even as he wanted to take the meadows which were not his own and give them to the workers of the world. While still in the prison cell wearing his red cap, clutching in his hands the sheaf of his poems as he waited for the lid of his coffin to be lifted for the release which he had both welcomed and feared, jailbird, Wilhelm Wittling had seemingly continued to turn a blind eye and deaf ear to an offer of free passage to the utopian cooperative community which Andreas Deich, who had been a brushmaker in the Swiss Alps, had recently founded in Darkest Missouri, and to which he had invited the seekers of light to come and share the plans devised and described by an idealistic utopian of no education but that which had been of the Red Heart in this little pamphlet entitled The Thousand-Year Kingdom, in which he had pointed out that the sufferings of the poor caused by the present unjust social and economic order had not been the work of God. Father in heaven did not want it so, only man has made it so. The community of New Helvetia, that which would so soon fade, no sign of its passage but a few graves soon to be covered over by the long grass, its founder to die alone in St. Louis of a broken heart because of his betrayal and abandonment by those in whom he had placed his idealistic, idyllic faith. All right. So it is interesting. I mean, I know we're not into Debs yet, but I find this background of the socialist communist thinking or thinkers at the time, I find it interesting because, I don't know, being in the U.S. and especially when I was born, it was the Red Scare, and if you read any of those books or thought any of those thoughts, it was just horrible and you were going to die. You're going to be tricked and die and all that kind of stuff. So all of this history is new to me, and it's interesting. All right. Thank you for listening. Bye.